Thank you for listening to this podcast from KX935, Laguna's only FM. We invite you to listen to more music and talk on our grassroots non-profit radio station in Laguna Beach, California, from anywhere in the world on kx935.com/listen or on our smartphone apps. But right now, here's that podcast from KX935.
I'm Marianne Williamson.
Jack Canfield.
Subanfu Somay.
I'm Doreen Virtue.
My name is Miguel Ruiz.
Hi, I'm Carolyn May.
This is James Van Prague, and you're listening to Inner Journey with Greg Friedman.
Keep doing what you're doing, Greg, balancing the negative radio broadcast with positive energy.
Welcome, guys. This is my first live broadcast since we've been back from India and Nepal. Thank you very much for hanging in. I hope you enjoyed Bruce Lipton while I was away. I got to tell you, he was absolutely phenomenal. You know the gig, sex, relationships, dream interpretation, anything that has to do with personal growth, we talk about it. We don't tell you what to do or even how to do it. This show is all about you, your strength, your power. We simply offer up pathways and possibilities. Say this every single week. Happiness takes courage. Love takes courage. And if you have the courage, come on an inner journey.
Listening to Inner Journey with Greg Friedman on KX 93.5 FM, community-supported radio in Laguna Beach, California.
Welcome back, guys. For those of you who don't know, I have been away in India and Nepal. I have had one of the most fantastic opportunities. Got an opportunity to fly out to India and teach at a growth-oriented conference. It was all about mind, body, and spirit. And for, excuse me. And for 4 days, and really for four nights, there were approximately 600 people, and all they wanted to do was learn. All they wanted to do was grow. And the way this conference was designed, it was mind, body, and spirit. And I got such a beautiful opportunity to recognize my own gift, my own song, my own reason for being here. Susan Huff, who I work with a great deal, talks about living your gift. In Dharma, it's about living your passion. For me, it's about, from the indigenous people, from the Native American, it's about finding your song. Well, this was my song. This is my song. Being here, being able to be of service, being in India, being able to be of service, it's such a gorgeous thing. And what I'm going to tell you is this. Everything else is dramatically less important. If you can find your song, find your purpose, live your gift, then whatever you do is going to be less arduous, less difficult, less of a battle, because you know that you're doing it from your heart and for your soul and for the universe. And if you could live from that place, I'm not telling you it's all going to be pretty and rainbows and sunshine coming out of your booty. What I'm going to say instead is, when it's hard, you know that it's hard for a reason. And that makes a huge, huge difference. And we'll be back with more Inner Journey with Greg Friedman and some of your email questions right after a little Sam and Dave.
I want it.
Short change.
You are listening to Inner Journey with Greg Friedman on KX 93.5 FM, community-supported radio in Laguna Beach, California. And I'm going to say it again. The monsters aren't under the bed. They're in your head.
All right, you guys, as promised, we are here on KX 93.5 FM, community-supported radio in Laguna Beach, California, taking some of your email questions. But I'm going to tell you, we're not going to do too many tonight because I am really jazzed. I dreamed a little dream, and then we have Robert Moss talking about dreams tonight. And if you haven't heard this man before, brilliant, insightful, has spent so many years really disentangling dreams in a way that you can understand them, that's not all woo-woo and very, very much applicable to your everyday life. It's a groovy thing. But, or and, we are here with Susan Huff. Say hello, Susan Huff.
Hello, Greg. I'm so happy to be here.
And who are you?
I am Susan Huff. I'm with Living Your Gifts. And I also run a nonprofit called Wisdom Spring and Walking for Water.
Which is?
It's a nonprofit that puts water wells in indigenous countries that need water.
Such as recently?
We were in...
Work with me.
Oh, okay. I'm struggling. We were in India, and we went to Kathmandu to see about putting a well there, and we have put in many, many, many wells in Burkina Faso, West Africa.
The one that we just put in 2 weeks ago was where?
It was outside of Nagpur.
Nagpur in India, and it was at a monastery.
Tibetan refugee camp.
Very, very cool. And it's not only for the camp itself. It feeds, I believe, three villages in the vicinity. Is that correct?
I think it feeds 1,000 people, but I'm not sure if it's a couple villages. I think they're intermingled, so I'm not sure about that.
And we got to go there with poisonous leaping snakes.
Oh my gosh, yes we did. It was quite the adventure on so many levels, and I'm still in, I would say, in a recovery place.
Interesting. All right, well, have you recovered enough to jump into an email question?
I certainly hope so.
All right, hopefully you didn't write this, because this is from Susan in Laguna Beach. And it says, I can't tell you how many times a day I run into people who just can't see the atrocities that are being perpetrated in this country. And I just want to scream at them and ask how they can be so blind. I realize that may not be the best choice, but need some help with another direction. Please help. Oh, you go first on this one. I like that.
Oh,
you go first.
Wow. I think a lot of people are in so much fear right now that hopefully they start to see what's really going on. I would say it to have a discussion. I think at this point we need to speak up how we feel, be not jerks about it, but say what we feel and have a conversation so maybe we can see each other's side and shift some energy around it.
I got to tell you, saying that worked as a catalyst for me because I really struggle with this question. I struggle in my personal life and I struggle answering Susan. But you saying that sort of gave me a little light. And my suggestion for Susan, my suggestion for myself, is listen and be curious. Just keep asking them questions, not with an agenda, but just keep asking questions about why they believe, what they believe, and how they believe, and can they see that this is going on, and how do they rectify the atrocities that are going on, like putting children and babies in prison and internment camps, with what we stand for as individuals in this country and what we stand for as a nation.
You know, I don't think if we don't start to dialogue, if we don't find a way to have a conversation with one another, we're going to stay polarized. That's my biggest fear. And there are times I want to be polarized, but I don't think that's working for me, and I don't think it's working for our country.
Yeah, I have to agree with you. I just think that whether we like it or not, we're going to have to open a dialogue. It's that simple. No more, no less.
Yeah.
And, you know, I got to tell you, there are so many fantastic questions in the queue for this evening, but I'm going to cut us short because I want us to be a little bit greedy and spend as much time as we can this evening with Robert Moss.
I am so excited about Robert Moss.
He is just a fantastic human being, and I can't wait to explore his insight. You are listening to Inner Journey with Greg Friedman, and we will be back right after a little John Lennon. Welcome back. You are listening to Inner Journey with Greg Friedman on KX 93.5 FM in Laguna Beach, California, and broadcast across the world. Tonight, we have somebody that I have been looking forward to having on for a great, great long time. You know, I've given a lot of introductions, but my guest description of himself may be one of my all-time favorites. He describes himself as such, says, "I am a storyteller and I help people to find and live their bigger and braver stories and tell them really well." I am so pleased to have the author of Mysterious Realities, Robert Moss, as a guest on my program this evening. Robert, welcome to Inner Journey.
Thank you, Greg. Great to be journeying with you.
It's such a pleasure. I'm going to begin with the first question that I ask every single guest, if you would indulge me, which is, we have had shaman, medicine men, authors, artists, people of service of virtually every different kind of pathway and possibility. To a person, there was a catalyst that thrust them on their path. True of you as well?
Well, yes. I mean, we can take this in two bites, if you like. The first catalyst was that I died and came back as a boy. That's what the doctor said when I was pronounced clinically dead at age three in a hospital in Hobart, Tasmania. Died of pneumonia, pronounced dead. And when I came back, the doctor said, "Oh, your boy died and he came back, didn't he?" Then at age nine, it happened again. And this time, when I died under an emergency appendectomy, I spent a whole life, it seemed, in another world. Had a wonderful time with really elegant, civilized, elongated, very pale and beautiful people, like humans, but not like humans up top. And when I came back, I remembered it all, was shocked to find myself in the body of a nine-year-old kid. And the adults around me couldn't understand how to deal with an experience like that. The first person I met who could give me a sort of explanation was an Aboriginal kid, you know, something about this. And he said to me, "Oh, yeah, we do that. We die, we come back. We go into the spirit world, and when we come back, we're sometimes the same and sometimes not." So, Greg, the catalyst in my early life is that by being thrown out of my body, I found I had a facility for being in other worlds and knew that other worlds beyond the physical were for real. I had a facility for dreaming. And then I did various things in my life for which my ability to dream and transfer consciousness without hallucinogenics, etc., was central. But then in midlife, more than 30 years ago now, it happened again. It wasn't the extremity of what we'd now call a near-death experience. This time it was moving to a farm on the edge of traditional Mohawk Indian country and finding myself in the middle of the night carried by on the wings of a red-tailed hawk, a bird that had become very important to me. I'm in the in-between state between sleep and awake, and I'm flying, and that's usual for me. That's not unusual. But I find myself riding with great delight a thermal on the wings of a red-tailed hawk and then being drawn into a cabin in the woods somewhere near where Montreal is today, but it's very primal territory. I'm in the presence of an ancient woman, ancient in years and ancient in time period, it seems, who talks to me beautifully in a voice like lake water lapping wave upon wave, beautiful cadence language, but I do not understand her speech. And this is renewed and it deepens, and eventually I find people who can help me to understand what I transliterate from her mind, from her speech. It's an archaic form of the Mohawk Indian language, the language of the Kanyankahaga, the people of the stone, and I have to learn it because of the dreams. And I realize that I am now in contact with a wise woman in a Rondiwano, a woman of power, from 250 years ago, and that she's called me for a reason. She's seeking survival keys in her own time from someone from her future. We have a connection with an Anglo-Irishman who lived in her time. So, Greg, the great catalyst in midlife, which made me give my life to becoming a teacher of what dreaming really is. I don't call myself a shaman. I call myself a dreamer. As you might know, in North America, the dominant word for shaman means one who dreams. In Mohawk, it's Radzedzots, one who dreams. What gave me the courage and the clarity to change my life and devote myself to the path I'm now on was my contact with this woman who was born Huron-Wendat, adopted by the Mohawk early, rose to become mother of the Wolf Clan of the Mohawk period. There's a historical record about her. I know her historical name. She called me. She called me 30 years ago. And she still turns up sometimes in my dreams and sometimes when she wants to get in contact. In the middle of the night, I'll see the form of a white wolf. and I'll follow it in from hypnagogic state to the in-between state, then I'm back in touch. So I've given you two catalysts, one from boyhood, which made sure that I would never confuse the physical world with the real world. It's only one world amongst many. And a midlife calling, which actually led me to change my life completely. So I hope that will do for an answer.
I think you've actually given me somewhere in the vicinity of 42 different catalysts. But let's circle around and work our way back, if we may. One of the questions that occurs to me when you tell me about being a 9-year-old boy, because there are so many of us that have profound experiences, especially as children. And because we are then looked at as weirdos or people, you must have dreamt it, it must mean nothing, we are dismissed or negated. How did you deal with that at 9 years old?
Well, I'll give you an answer that may or may not surprise you. It was very, very difficult. I was very, very lonely. And by the way, my crises of illness in childhood were not confined to those extreme experiences. I was sick. I had a hard time living in the world. I had double pneumonia in both lungs 12 times from the ages of 3 and 11. So a lot of my life was spent in the twilight of sick rooms. So I'm lonely. I'm having these experiences. It's very difficult, if not impossible, to talk to them about them to the people around me. But I have an invisible companion amongst the others. Big man, a lot of white hair, pink face, sits on the side of my bed. I can feel him sitting down as I talk to you. And he says to me, Robert, I know you're lonely, but you'll make it through. You'll survive. I promise you will do that. You're lonely, but you'll know the love of women and they'll love you. You can't tell your dreams and stories easily right now, but the day will come when the world will really want to hear them. Greg, I'm talking about visitations to my boy self from my older self, younger than I am now. I started learning to apply the fact that we time travel in our dreams to doing something to help my younger self get through. I consciously started traveling back to my younger self to help him make it through. And I teach other people that this is one of the things that you can do in dreaming. We time travel in dreams. We can travel to an older and hopefully wiser self from this life. We can journey to a younger self, be the cheerleader, the counselor, the mentor, the friend that they might need. And of course, we can travel to selves in other places and other times. So that is one of the things that got me through my childhood. And dreaming got me through, because not only did I have visitations from an older Robert, I had encounters with other mentors and counselors, not in this world, but in other worlds, who remain central to my understanding of reality.
You do know that every time you answer me, it elicits just a myriad of other questions that I want to ask you.
Good.
So going back a little bit, when you were 9 years old and you were visited by your older self, did you recognize who you were at that time?
No. No, I mean, we're now playing memory games. I mean, they're serious games, they're important games, but I don't think my child self, not only at 9 but at other ages, quite understood who was calling on him. I'd have to make another journey and go into his mind to find out whether he knew what was going on. What I am telling you is that my older self, as I repeat, younger than I am now, decades younger than I am now, he understood what he was doing. And I don't think that he necessarily revealed his identity to my young self, if that makes sense to you.
Absolutely.
I think it was sufficient for him to appear as the kind of guide that you trust, the one that gets you through. What I draw from this is the understanding that one of the gifts of dreaming, conscious dreaming, active dreaming, as I call it, is to realize that we are not bound to linear time, nor are we bound to the body and the brain. We're in the field of non-local mind and its expansive availability of information. But one of the things that we can really do, we wake up to the fact that in dreams we travel across time, as we can learn to do it consciously, we can do something as important and sometimes as life-sustaining as going back to that younger self who's lonely or sick or traumatized or in grief and abuse and difficult situations and tell him or her, you're going to make it through. At the very least, we can say to our younger self, you're going to make it. You will survive. I promise you. And life will one day be safe and it will be fun.
And if I hear you correctly, because in my experience, there's a plethora of teachers, of healers, of people of service that do find themselves somewhat isolated, especially early on. And if I hear you and understand you, what you're suggesting is, as an adult, you can go back and shift the dynamic, shift the paradigm that will not only affect what happens to that child, but then as a consequence affect how you show up in the world in the present. Is that accurate?
Absolutely, yeah. Absolutely. You can revise the experience of the world and the attitude to the world of that younger self. Will this change the actual event track, the actual course of your personal history? Well, it might. If it does, of course, then you're going to split your world and you're going to end up in an alternate reality. So you might not get to the point you started at, you know. But at the very least, I know that you can transform for the better the thoughts, the feelings, the experience of the world of a younger self. I've told you one of many personal stories of doing this, but I've helped other people to do it, and I've seen astonishing results. I think it can be profoundly healing, both for us in our present time and for that younger person in their own now time, because we're talking about traveling into the now time of someone living, you know, years ago. Not just going back in memory and picturing this, but actually going back into the now time, example of that 9-year-old lonely kid and doing some good in that time.
And is there anything that you could offer up to our listeners this evening? Other than, and this is important, going to your website, going and accessing your books and your tapes and your YouTube and so many different places people could get a hold of you. Is there a tool that you could offer them to help on the pathway to accessing their younger selves?
Well, The first thing is to wake up to what's going on in your dreams anyway before you decide to do anything consciously. I mean, one of the predominant problems in our time is that so many people are going through a dream drought and they run off to try drugs or do something else if they're interested in transcendence because they're not in touch with the most simple way of entering an altered state of consciousness, which is to connect with your spontaneous dreams of the night. So the first tool that you need is to wake up to what's going on in your dreams. That might begin with beginning again to remember what's going on in the night. So it's as basic and as simple as that and as difficult for many people on hurried schedules to, again, tap into the dream source, tap into what your dreaming self is doing. Dreaming is traveling. I mean, this is the central idea in my new book of stories of dream travel, Mysterious Realities, that in dreaming, as ancient and indigenous cultures teach us, we go traveling and we receive visitations from other travelers who might be other dreamers, the departed, or spiritual beings. So if you want to go and visit your younger self, you can do it as a meditation, of course. You can picture yourself looking from, let's say, well, let's give you an exercise. But I do want to make the impassioned appeal that it begins with waking up to what is available to you in dreams spontaneously. That is your birthright and part of your humanity. Because if you don't dream, if you're not in touch with your dreams, in the view of indigenous cultures, as you might have heard, Greg, you're not fully human. It might mean you've lost part of your soul, part of your dream soul.
Anyway, whoa,
about that, Mysterious Realities, is quite terrifying.
Wait, before you go on, I apologize for interrupting. That was such a vital piece of information that and once in a while I'm going to jump in here and ask you to slowly repeat something because it's really vital that our listeners hear what you just said about dreaming and your soul. Could you please go back and revisit that?
All right. You're welcome to tell me to slow down. You know, the first time I talked in led a workshop in California, the Esalen Institute, ages ago, someone said to me, "You're from New York." I said, "Is the accent?" "No, it's the speed," they said. Uh-huh. So you can tell me to slow down.
Well, look, the only reason I would tell you to slow down is because you have such a huge, vast amount of information to share. And I want to make sure that it's not gone over so quickly that it's missed. And these people get the opportunity to ingest it. So thank you for that.
All right. Well, we have to get our dreams back. If you're not in touch with your night dreams, something is missing. I will say that fiercely and passionately. You might have any kind of practice. You might have a shamanic practice. You might do yoga. You might do meditation. You might do tai chi, all that good stuff. But if you're not in touch with the spontaneous dreams of the night, including the ones that you don't ask for and do not want, something is missing. This is the insight of ancient indigenous cultures. When I studied the Iroquois tradition, tradition of the peoples of the Longhouse because of my own dreams, I learned very early on that traditionally in that culture, if you're missing your dreams of the night, it's because you've lost part of your soul, part of your dream soul. I found that repeated in other cultures. There's a story in my new book, Mysterious Realities, called Dream Takers, which is really quite terrifying, but hopeful at the end, about what happens to a society when people have lost their dreams, because part of their soul, part of their dream soul, has gone missing. You lose that, you've lost a lot. You've lost the voice of conscience and the prompt to course correction, because one of the great things about spontaneous night dreams is they hold up a mirror to our everyday actions and attitudes. They give us a perspective, a witness perspective on what we're doing. Sometimes it's shocking, sometimes it's humorous. Most cultures that have known what they're doing spiritually in the course of human evolution have understood beyond that that dreaming is important for three basic reasons. Number one, we're talking now about spontaneous dreams, not all that process, not all that practice you've learned over the years, but what is available to you any night if you're open to it. The number one reason why dreaming in this basic sense is important is it puts us in touch with a source of wisdom that is much deeper than the regular, ordinary mind. It puts us in touch with the God, goddess we can talk to. It puts us in touch with the spirits of nature. It puts us in touch with the ancestors, with the self, or the higher self, if you like. Most cultures have understood that. Number two, most cultures that have known what they're doing spiritually have understood, and in practical terms have understood, that in dreams we see the future. It goes on all the time. I take the conservative mainstream view that nothing happens in our lives until it is dreamed. In fact, in the state of dreaming, we might select the events that are going to manifest in our world. I mean, quantum physics, with its talk about the observer effect, suggests something similar. I know this for certain sure. In dreams, we see things before they happen that can save your life, save your job, save your relationship, set you on the path to a good relationship, a good home. All the rest of it. I wouldn't be talking to you, Greg, if I had not avoided death on the road three times, to my certain knowledge, by looking at dreams of the possible future and applying the information. Number three, most human societies have valued dreams and dreamers because they understand that dreaming relates to healing and medicine. Dreams diagnose what's going on in the body. They give images spontaneously that even if we don't like them originally, we can work towards healing and resolution. Any image that belongs to you can be a source of healing and resolution. And dreams, most importantly, perhaps, show us the state of the soul. They show us where soul has gone. You dream of being back in grandma's place. Maybe that's telling your child part of yourself has been hiding out because of scary stuff in your childhood, and you follow the road of that dream. Maybe you can bring that back, that child's self. So those are some of the things about why dreaming is fundamental, and I'll say it one more time. In North America, where we are talking, the word for shaman isn't shaman. That comes from Central Asia. It's a useful word. My friend Moshe Eliade, I mentioned him because there's a story about Moshe Eliade in the afterlife in my book, Mysterious Realities. Eliade, the great scholar of mythology and religion from Romania, popularized the word shaman when he published a book on shamanism back in 1953. But, you know, in North America, the word in most indigenous languages that we translate as dreamer or healer, is as shaman or healer, means one who dreams. So dreaming is central to all of this.
It's so much incredibly valuable information. We're going to have to take a short break for our national syndicates and station ID. But when we come back, I'd really like to touch on a phrase that you used a little bit earlier. And that phrase is dream drought. Hold on one moment, and we'll return with more Inner Journey with Greg Friedman and our guest, author of Mysterious Realities, A Dream Traveler's Tale from the Imaginal Realm. And Robert Moss, right after this.
You are listening to Inner Journey with Greg Friedman on KX 93.5 FM, community-supported radio, in Laguna Beach, California. And I'm going to say it again. The monsters aren't under the bed. They're in your head.
Welcome back. You are listening to Inner Journey with Greg Friedman. And this evening, we have the extreme pleasure of hanging out with Robert Moss. His latest book is called Mysterious Realities. Robert, welcome back.
Thank you, Greg.
Before we left for break, I had mentioned, used a phrase earlier that I'd like to delve into a bit, if you'll indulge me. And that phrase is dream drought. Will you talk to us about what that means, first of all? And secondly, if we are experiencing a dream drought, some of the pathways out of it and back into our dream world.
Right. Well, dream drought is almost pandemic in modern society, by it which I mean that many of us, whatever practices we might think we have tuned out or closed off our memory to what's going on in the night in terms of spontaneous dreams during sleep and during that fascinating liminal space between sleep and awake. I'm a great proponent of doing more in the twilight zone of hypnagogia. You're not asleep, you're not awake, you're somewhere in between. If you can stop cussing because you're awake in the middle of the night and open to the images that rise in that period, you're on your way to becoming a lucid dreamer, and you're on your way maybe to practicing the kind of continuity of consciousness that real dream yoga types value. But many of us have tuned all of that. We're not open to spontaneous sleep dream experiences. We're not open to experiences in that liminal zone. So in that sense, we're suffering a dream drought. And it's a serious condition. I talked earlier about all that might be going on in dreaming that you're missing out on. I talked about how dreams are a magic mirror, offering course correction on your current actions and behavior. And I talked about many other aspects. You're also missing out on the movies. You're missing out on fabulous sources of entertainment and instruction. And in the view of ancient and indigenous cultures, you're missing out on your easiest and most direct way of being in tune with the sacred, being in tune with the spirit world and with spontaneous revelation. So, you know, if you have the slight feeling from time to time that, you know, you are missing out on the movies, what do you do? Well, the first thing you do is you stop telling yourself you don't remember anything in the morning. You spend a moment when you wake up or in the middle of the night, whenever you wake up, and you see what's with you. It might just be a fragment, a wisp, a bit of a soundtrack, a bit of a song or something, a sense of color. But if you've been out of touch with your dreams, you then write something down. So part of the practice, and this is the most vital tool, Greg, is to keep a journal. And the journal might initially, if you haven't been keeping one, not have much in it. If you're going to start with your dream recording, you don't have much. But you write something down, the first thoughts, the first feelings, the somatic sensations. You put something in your journal, and when you do that, you say to the sources of your dreams, to your dream producers, I'm here, I'm ready to listen. You vary your schedule a bit. You know, you stop waking up to the alarm clock, or if you have to have an alarm clock, you set it earlier. So you've got time to linger and languor in the in-between state before you have to get out of bed and see what is with you. You also remember that if you're not in touch with dreams of the night, the world around you will speak in the manner of dreams if you pay attention. I mean, I'm a great proponent of living by synchronicity. I coined the term chiromancy, which means living by the special moments, the kairos moments of synchronicity, being ready to notice them. And what I do every day, which is a dreamer's practice, to dreaming with your eyes wide open, is when I go out on the street or in the park, wherever I go first thing, I'm alert to what the world around me is saying. All of my senses are a quiver. I might get a message from an overheard snatch of conversation. I might get a message from the dog on that street corner. I might get a message from the hawk in the air. I might get a message from the bumper sticker or logo on that car or truck. But I'm going to go out into the world every day, understanding the world around me will speak to me in the manner of dream symbols if I will pay attention. And I'll make a story and sometimes get a very practical or even urgent message from what pops up in the forest of living symbols all around me. Australian Aborigines talk of living in the speaking land. The mountain is speaking, the river is speaking, the lizard is speaking, and in our modern urban circumstances, so is everything around us. The traffic jam is speaking. You know, the encounter on the street corner is speaking. The kid's chalk drawing on the sidewalk is speaking. So paying attention to fragments, varying your schedule a bit, and I'll tell you something else that assists dream recall. It helps to break the dream drought. It is having a method of talking about this stuff to a friend or even a stranger that makes it fun and rewarding. You know, we do not have a social reward system for people who remember and want to talk about dreams, nor typically we know how to talk about dreams very well. I invented a four-step process, which I call the lightning dream work. I introduced it at an international conference back in 2000. It's in several of my books, including Active Dreaming and The Three Only Things. It's a four-step process which, like lightning, hence the name, is meant to focus energy and get things done very quickly. And it's a four-step process by which we can learn to tell our stories to each other, have a partner ask some relevant questions, and then give some non-authoritarian feedback, if it were my dream, if it were my life, and then help us to decide on an action plan. It's fun. You can do it in minutes. It delivers creative and healing action. You can do it in the corner at the office. You can do it at the coffee shop in the morning. You can do it at the supermarket checkout. You can do it in minutes. And, you know, if you've got a process like that, and you can take more time for it, of course, then you've got an incentive to bring something to the table. You've got an incentive to bring a dream. If you don't have the dream, you bring a story of some kind, and that gets it going. That opens the spigot. Because, you know, in traditional cultures have often done this. First business of the day in a dreaming society is to share dreams, support the dreamer in recognizing what the soul might be saying in the dream, celebrate the good story value of a certain kind of dream, and maybe see if there's something in it for the community as a whole. So I don't want to fail to feature this aspect of what it means to break the dream drought and bring back the dreaming. We need a social reward system that makes it fun in everyday circumstances to do this, and so quick you have no excuse for not doing it any time you have something to share.
And I'll tell you that what I heard in between there as well is that what you are a huge proponent of is finding your tribe, finding a village, finding a community that you could actually share this kind of information with.
Absolutely. But of course, this is an international tribe. It's not tribal in the atavistic sense. It's international. I mean, I founded a school of active dreaming. That's what we call it, active dreaming. It's the fusion, it's the synthesis of contemporary dream work and ancient shamanism and the methods, frankly, that mystics, bards, and poets have used since forever to go to interesting places. My books on this are in 21 languages. It's being taught actively in 21 countries. So wherever I go, I'm with my community and tribe, if you want to call it, but it's more than the problem with tribe. I know what you mean. It's got a warm, cozy feeling. But the slight problem is that, you know, the tribe can be exclusive, and this is not exclusive. This is everyday practice. We build a family. I prefer the term family or community. We build a family of people who support each other's soul odysseys wherever they are. We bridge cultural gaps. We bridge tribal, you know, taboos, and we do it that way. But it is very important to do this in company. I mean, this is a social activity. Sometimes we think that dreaming is very solitary, and I suppose the big experiences will be individual ones. But dreaming is social in a number of senses. First of all, when you get that out there and you're dreaming, whether you're dreaming in the night, in a sleep dream or the hypnagogic state, or you're journeying like a shaman, you're not alone. You're amongst other people. You might be more social in your dreams than you are in ordinary life. We get out there, we meet other people, we meet the dead who are alive somewhere else, we go to other worlds, other communities. And then in our ordinary lives, we want to learn to get social with our dreams in the sense of knowing how to talk about them to other people in a way that captures the attention of other people. So this becomes a tremendous training in storytelling and communicating. And that's incredibly empowering for people who have not been accustomed to being heard when they want to tell their truth. And then we support each other because we gather around each other tenderly in this kind of community. We listen to what the soul is saying in dreams, and we help each other to enact what the soul wants. And that can change everything.
Robert, we have about 5 minutes before the top of the hour. We have whipped through this hour. Do you think that you could respond to the question I'm going to ask within those 5 minutes, or should we save it till the next hour?
Well, I haven't heard the question, Greg. How can I possibly know?
I wasn't done yet. I was setting it up.
Okay.
It's this. You made a distinction just now between dreaming and dreaming like a shaman. Could you explain the distinction?
Well, when I said dreaming like a shaman just then, I was talking about journeying. I was talking about the deliberate soul voyage of the shaman. This is a form of dreaming. That's what it is. It is dreaming. But it's reflected in some of the language. Amongst the Maquiritari of Venezuela, for example, the word for a dream is an atacato, which means a journey of the soul. When I say dreaming like a shaman, I'm talking about deliberately setting out to journey beyond the body and the brain in a certain modality. In my practice, we don't use hallucinogenics. We don't do drugs. In the workshops, we use drumming. So dreaming like a shaman might mean using, for example, percussion to fuel and focus the journey. But we're talking about a spectrum of experience. And I've heard of people of Amazonia quoted as saying, quote, everyone who dreams is a little bit shaman. Everyone who dreams is a little bit shaman. I mentioned earlier on that in the languages of North America, indigenous North America, the prime characteristic of the shaman is that this is a person who dreams strong. So, you know, in the spectrum of ability and practice, I would say that not to have tried to avoid confusion, that the dream shaman, someone who dreams like a shaman, is someone who has developed the ability to shift consciousness at will, journey to interesting places, bring back gifts, and deliver results. But probably when I was using the phrase the way you quoted earlier, I was talking about the focused shamanic journey, which in my groups we do with the aid of percussion. In my private practice, I don't even use that very much because for the reasons I gave you, since childhood, I've had the ability to sort of flick an inner switch and just go there.
Absolutely beautiful. Robert, if people want to find out more about you personally and also find out how to get a hold of your book, Mysterious Realities, how would they go about doing that?
Well, my website is mossdreams.com. That's my surname, like the stuff that grows on trees, M-O-S-S, dreams, plural, mossdreams.com. So that's a starting point. Mysterious Reality is the new book for which I feel the fierce pride of a new father and the delight in a book which is really a set of amazing stories of travels in different worlds and travels in this world, empowered by living on the mythic edge and the crackling of synchronicity. You can find it from the usual online suspects, and you can find it in any decent bookstore.
And I have to tell you, it's really a marvelous book because I think pretty much everybody knows one of the easiest ways, one of the greatest ways that we learn is through stories. And you not only teach us about dreams, but you teach us through experiential by taking us on a vicarious journey in your stories. And I thank you for that because you do it so artfully. And I urge everybody listening right now, go out and get this book. It's a great way to dive in, to understand without feeling like you're reading a textbook, but instead you're going on a journey with Robert Moss and his dreams.
Well, thank you, Greg.
You are quite welcome. Will you hang out for the next hour with us right after this
Absolutely.
Break?
Absolutely.
Thank you very much for doing that. You are listening to Inner Journey with Greg Friedman on KX93.5 FM and worldwide. We'll be back right after the top of the hour.
My name is Greg Friedman. I am a modern version of those that have existed in every culture. I am a guide. For years, I have taken people all over the world to work with indigenous elders in exotic locations, only to show you that you are the magic, and we just help you realize it. It can be terrifying to look at our fears, and sometimes, even more so, to look at our strengths. I take you out into the wild, into the unknown, for an inner journey.
Welcome back. You are listening to Inner Journey with Greg Friedman on KX93.5 FM, community-supported radio in Laguna Beach, California. You know, it is rare that we get somebody that is a font of knowledge like Robert Moss. Robert has written innumerable books, taught workshop after workshop, and has led people through journey work down the rabbit hole and back into themselves. And Robert, I am so ecstatic that you have graced our program. Thank you very much for joining us on Inner Journey.
It's a wonderful program, Greg, and I like the way you describe yourself. When I was listening to your self-description, I was remembering a moment in the Purgatorio in Dante's Divine Comedy when somebody asks Dante why he is traveling, and he says, "I journey to return to who I am." So that's what all of this is about. You lead journeys in the outer world to help people make the inner journey, as you describe yourself. I make a number of outer journeys myself. If you read Mysterious Realities, you'll find me at the ancient sanctuary of the goddess in Ephesus. You'll find me in the mountains of Transylvania. You'll find me other places in this world. But it's all about, as you say, finding ourselves on the inner path and finding the courage to follow it to where it needs to take us.
I'm going to take advantage of this moment and ask you a question from my own personal experiences. A long time ago, I was about to lead a group of people to work in a tributary of the Amazon with a Shipibo shaman. And before I left, everybody that was going on that journey would call me daily and say, you did this with me in your dreams, and you did this with me in my dreams, and you did this. And I could only remember one. And it was driving me one out of all those dozen or so dreams. And it was driving me absolutely crazy. Finally, I went to an elder. And he said, you only have one ego, which is why you can remember this. How do you feel about that response? And do you have a different take on it?
I don't know. I mean, we have doubles. We really do have doubles. I mean, let's remember we live in the many worlds. I mean, this is not some fringe opinion. This is becoming a consensus in physics. We live right now, according to the many worlds interpretation of reality, in one of countless parallel universes. So why shouldn't we, according to the interpretation of physics, have many selves who are out there and might be perceived in dreams and in other ways on parallel tracks? I receive on average, Greg, every day of my life, 40 coherent, detailed dream reports of what people think I'm doing in their dreams. Now, sometimes I remember nothing from any dream of mine that resembles anything they share with me. Nonetheless, some of these are collective situations like workshops. I often dream I'm teaching during the night. I do more teaching during the night in my dreams than I do during the day. So I'm open to the idea that we've met each other, just as your people going on the trip with you might meet with you. We might be scouting forward and checking out a future situation that we'll be in together. You know, it is impossible for one feeble or even brilliant brain to retain and hold on to more than a finite amount of information from any world. So I wouldn't worry too much about not having complete recall of what other people say they've done with you. I will note that psychology would tell us that if someone's dreaming of you or me, it's a projection of some part of themselves is like you or me. That's not the shamanic or the ancient approach. It's a relevant approach in modern lives because we are psychological. We're Western psychological in so many ways. But the ancient and indigenous tradition is that dreaming is transpersonal, not just personal. We get out there, we meet each other. Nonetheless, as I say, it is impossible to hold more than a finite amount of information. But I'd actually like to tell you a story about how the dream might be your passport to an indigenous culture. And I'm going to go Aboriginal. Is that all right with you for a moment?
Are you kidding me? I've done work with Aboriginal elders.
I know you have. That's why I'm offering it to you. And I'm Australian.
I appreciate that immensely.
You may have spent more
immensely.
Time with Aborigines than I have since I'm an absentee Australian. I've been out of the country most of my life. But I want to tell you a story about how dreams can be a visa or passport to an indigenous tradition. So I'm an absentee Australian, right? So I'm living in the United States, and I dream that a sea eagle, a bird native to the north coast of Australia, of eastern Australia, and to northern Scotland, where my father's people come from, a sea eagle flies me. It's in the liminal state. I'm between sleep and awake. A sea eagle comes to me. It flies me across the continent, across the Pacific. I live on the east coast in the United States, back to the Gold Coast of Australia, where my mother is living, and we're having a conversation. I want to come out of the dream and talk to her because we've been having hard times. I'm aware it's a dream, and I need to call her. But no, the sea eagle insists on taking me into the hinterland, into the bush. Another animal takes over. Now I'm on the edge of a muddy stream, and there's something huge thrashing in the water. I don't know what it is. Is it a serpent? Is it a dragon? I don't know. A fish? Huge. And then I noticed that there are Aborigines painted the ceremony, and an elder says to me, very simply says, this is the first of all creatures. This is the beginning of our world. And I come back. I'm not saying I wake up because it's a lucid dream. It's a journey. It's a spontaneous journey. 3 months later, my mother dies, unexpectedly, except that I knew from the dream that something was looming, and we'd been in touch, and I called her. So now I'm in Australia for the funeral. Now I do something rather, you know, Australian. I go walkabout for a while. I've lost my last close blood relative in my native country, so I go walkabout. I find myself in a dusty town in the hinterland called Bow Desert in southeast Queensland. Mm-hmm. And I go into the Aboriginal housing co-op. I don't know why. Cheerful rugby player greets me, and I start telling him a dream. He says, oh, wait, no, dreams. Got to talk to Frank. Who's Frank? He's our spirit man, he says. Where's Frank? 3 miles hard bush walk away, and I'm not up for that, but in the way of shamans, Frank walks in. So we go down the pub. He doesn't drink. He just has orange juice. I'm an Australian. I'll have a beer. And he's sniffing me, literally, Greg. You know, this is another white man come to rip us off. You know, he's literally sniffing me, mm-hmm. smelling me. I start telling him the dream, and everything changes. His eyes shine like opals. He's very still. He says, oh, mate, "You were sent to us for a bloody reason," he says. "You've just told me the start of the creation story is told to made men of the Mananjali tribe." He tells me, "What I dreamed in the creek, in the stream, is the bush eel. Excuse me, the bull eel, and they call it the first of all creatures in their creation story." So my dream becomes a visa, it becomes a passport. He takes me, skirting quicksand, to the place of the bull eel dreaming. And fortunately, the bull eel is not in the water, but otherwise it's the scene from my dream. And he invites me to sit with the elders of the assembled southeast tribes of the Aborigines of Queensland.
Wow.
Because of my dream. So you see, dreaming is valued in traditional dreaming societies, of course, through the clash with modern cultures and through the fact that the dominant culture has often lost its own dreaming. This is not necessarily alive the extent it used to be, and alcoholism and other things come in and people forget how to dream. But it is absolutely central to the most ancient form of spiritual practice. And this is what I, in my way, am bringing back. And perhaps in your way, even if you use different terms and use different practices, maybe in your own way, it's what, in a sense, you're bringing back too.
Absolutely. And that brings us to journeying. You've mentioned earlier that you don't like to use any plants, and which I completely respect, and that's not a pathway for everybody, and neither should it be. But you have also mentioned that you use drums. And to me, drums are as big, music is as big medicine as anything that there is in the world. Will you talk a little bit about why you choose drums and what it does for your journeys and perhaps even what a journey would look like?
Yeah, I've recently started telling people that shamanic drumming is a sheepdog for the brainwaves. It hurts the brainwaves in a useful direction. That's what it is. It fuels and focuses a journey. Probably more important in my practice and teaching than the drumming itself is setting the right intention and providing the right portal. I mean, one of the ways that I've married dream work to shamanism, Greg, is I teach people to take a personal dream or personal image and make that the gateway for the journey, not some prefabricated upper world, lower world script, which is fine as far as it goes. But if you, for example, have had a dream which has some energy for you, it might be the energy of terror, it might be a nightmare, it might be a broken dream you ran away from, then it might have mystery or romance. It might have someone in it you'd like to talk to. It might have information you need to check out so that, for example, you can avoid the car accident on Tuesday or find your way to the right job. You have a dream that has some energy for you. You can take that dream, pull it up on your mental screen, and journey through the image, through the memory of the dream. In the workshops, we use shamanic drumming to facilitate that journey. Once you become practiced, you might not need the drumming at all. Would you like to hear an example of this?
Of course.
Okay, so a woman comes to one of my workshops in a foreign country called New York City long ago, okay? She's never done anything with her dreams. She's never done any shamanic journey, has no idea. But she has a dream that has a lot of juice and energy, and she tells it to us, and she says, "You know, in my dream, I'm back in elementary school. Actually, I'm up on the roof, and the difference is the building is much taller. The elementary school building has many more stories." And she says, "And there are children playing on the roof, and there's a beautiful fair-haired girl in a red coat, maybe 5 years old. And I'm so drawn to the girl," says the dreamer, "but I'm worried. There's no railing around the roof. They're playing wildly. I'm frightened the girl will fall to her death. And I reach her," says the dreamer, "she grabs my hand, and I'm screaming because we're going to be killed, and suddenly we're flying over the rooftops, and this is the dream." So we're looking at her. Mm-hmm. I don't want to do interpretation of this dream. I say, "Look, dear, if it's my," and we talk about her feelings, of course, and some reality check, "is this your school?" I say, "If it's my dream, I want to go back inside. I want to ask the girl herself, 'Who are you? Would you like to do that?'" She has no idea what I'm talking about. I hold up the drum. I say, "Look, we've got this gee whiz technology. It's helped people to shift consciousness for a while. It's helped them to fly. Would you like to give it a go?" "Yes," she says, "I'd love to try. What do I do?" I said, "You make yourself comfortable. You relax. You breathe out anything that's holding you back. Nothing is holding her back. She wants to go. And you formulate your intention." Greg, this is so important. A precise, clear, juicy, energizing intention. "What is your intention?" I said, "I want to meet that 5-year-old girl and find out who she is." "Great." Says, "Wait a minute, can I have a second intention?" "Yes, yes. I want to see if I can fly by myself." "Okay, we've got intentions. She's going to relax. I'm going to drum for it. She's going to re-enter a dream." I say, "Wait a minute. We've got 30 people in this room who will be bored to death just watching me tap the drum and you lying down. Can we all come with you? What? What do you mean? Oh, well, look, with your invitation, with your permission, we'll all come with you into your dream and support you, be your family, and if you like, give you information from our point of view. So we set up a plan. As I tell this to you, I'm laying out a typical Robert Martha-led shamanic journey centered on a dream. So 30 people now, with permission, are going to journey into the dream of the girl in the red coat on the roof of the school building. And she's right there. I start drumming. She is there. I see her. Others see her. We are together, conscious, wide awake in the dream. No plant medicine, nothing else. Just focused intention and some simple drumming. And I see what happens. And when she comes back, she confirms it. She goes to the girl in the red coat, and she discovers it is her five-year-old self who left her, to what shamans call soul loss. Because of bad stuff in the family when she was very young. And what did she do? What would you do? You see a beautiful five-year-old self. She hugs her, right? A light comes on in her heart. A light comes on in the heart of the five-year-old. And now there is no separate five-year-old. The five-year-old is in her heart, and spontaneous soul retrieval is accomplished in that moment. And she is different. Well, she's frisky. The left-brain skeptic is coming in before the end of the drumming. So she thinks, I need to confirm what all of this is about. So she jumps off the roof, confirming she can fly, has a delightful sensation of flight as the drumming continues, and she flies up to see Uncle Fred in Minneapolis, you know, get some verification of what's going on. Now, you and I might not fly to Minneapolis, a perfectly fine city.
I don't know, Fred's a nice guy.
But she goes. She checks on Uncle Fred. When she comes back, she tells us the story. She looks 15 years younger. And then she says, I've got to go and call Fred. She runs out, phones him, gets confirmation of what she saw during her journey, and Fred is amazed that she saw. So that's an example of the kind of journey that I lead. This one resulted in spontaneous soul retrieval. So it's a pretty interesting story.
Yeah, I love this. And I agree entirely with what you're saying. I say incessantly the three necessary ingredients for any journey is intention, integrity, and a really well-trained, clear, strong guide. And it seems like you are on the same page that you include all of those in your journeys as well.
Yeah, I can endorse that.
Now, I'm going to ask you something horribly unfair. I'm going to ask you to choose from all of your children, two children. So you have a myriad of nonfiction books. You have one called Sidewalk Oracles. You have The Boy Who Died and Came Back, Dreaming the Soul Back Home, Active Dreaming, Dream Gates, The Secret History of Dreaming, The Three Only Things, only in quotation marks, The Dreamer's Book of the Dead, Dream Ways of the Iroquois, Dreaming True, and Conscious Dreaming, as well as your latest book, Mysterious Realities. I'm going to ask you to choose two, one for a beginner and one for an advanced, that you'd suggest as the gateway for them, the opening, so they are going to be driven not only to discover themselves, but to discover themselves through delving deeper into the whole series of books that you have to offer.
Well, thanks for the invitation. I'm going to blur the divide between beginner and advanced, because all of my books are going to take you deep. And I think in terms of the practice, let's put it this way, a book that gives you the practice, the how-to of these things, given the story I just told, I'm going to recommend Dreaming the Soul Back Home, whose subtitle is Shamanic Dreaming for Healing and Becoming Whole. I think it would appeal very much to anybody who's on a shamanic path and anybody who is concerned, as all of us might be, about what happens to soul in the course of a life and how you get it back and how you bring more of your parts together. And it's got a lot of basic practice as well as a lot of wonderful stories for everybody, beginner or advanced. I am going to boost my new book, Mysterious Realities, not only because it's new, but because it's different. I mean, it reads like fiction, but it's nonfiction. It's absolutely just those stories. In other words, they're absolutely real, factual experiences of life led in different realities and life led on the mythic edge in the course of everyday life. There are stories in which you can read about my conversations with Mr. Jung, yes, Carl Gustav Jung, in his new afterlife situation in the Other Bollingen. I mean, read it. See what you make of my account of what he considers his masterwork, the book he's been writing since death. It's the purple book, not the red book, and the introduction is titled why I'm not a Jungian. I mean, try that. Try the story titled When Dreams Keep Playing, about what's going on when you get a recurring dream and what your personal movie production company making dreams for you behind the scenes thinks of you, and they're getting bored to death having to make the same effing dream for you because you won't get the message or act upon it. I mean, it's a book full of humor. It's full of edge. It starts with my relationship with my personified death, which puts me in the Scheherazade role of needing by agreement to produce an entertaining story every day. And I think it's a book for people at all levels. It goes deeper than this world, but it does so with beauty and terror and joy.
And once again, all of those books can be found on mossdreams.com.
Robert, yeah, you've got a list. You've got a complete listing of them there, and they should all be available to you from the usual online sellers and from any decent bookstore.
Fantastic. We're going to take one more station ID break for our national syndicates. We'll be back within 30 seconds. Hold on.
You are listening to Inner Journey with Greg Friedman on KX 93.5 FM, community-supported radio in Laguna Beach. I don't care how much you flap your arms and kick your feet, if you are still holding on to the side of the pool, you ain't swimming.
Welcome back. You know, every once in a while we come across one of those shows, and I'll tell you, if you weren't here for the entire thing, go back and listen to this podcast. We are here this evening with Robert Moss. His latest book is called Mysterious Realities. But the bottom line is you are a virtual encyclopedia, Robert, of dreams. And not only a how-to, but absolutely a how-to, but really different facets and aspects and different ways to delve in, which, as you and I have discussed earlier, are in essence just different ways of self-discovery. And but in just such a sweet, common, and I don't mean common in a derogatory sense at all, common fashion. We all dream. And what you do is you take something that's accessible to all of us and you illuminate it as a key to ourselves. Thank you for doing that.
Well, you're a gentleman and a scholar, Greg, as they say in Britain. You're a gentleman and a scholar, man of taste and discernment. What is central to me in all of this is that this is our birthright. This is available to everyone. I am very sad that many people have closed themselves to it. Closed themselves to what? Closed themselves to the spontaneous wisdom, energy, and guidance of night dreams, and close themselves to the way, to the speaking land, to the way, as we discussed, that synchronicity, special moments of coincidence, chance encounters, signs and symbols are popping up in the world around you. Because these two sources of knowledge, you know, do give us course correction. They do give us a readout on what we're doing in our lives. And they sometimes can get you through difficult passages which ordinary resorts are not enough. It's especially in difficult times and scary times, and my goodness, we are in scary times in so many ways, that we need these tools for soul and survival, and we have access to them. Now, of course, dreaming is a practice. It's a discipline, as yoga is a discipline, as painting with oils is a discipline, as archaeology or particle physics is a discipline. You get good at it, in other words, by practice, 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 by those famous 10,000 hours that might be a condition for excellence in any field. But, you know, when you think about it, if you're a dreamer, you've got a head start on everybody else. You can do it in your sleep, literally. And you can do it in your daily life once you wake up to the fact that the world around you is alive and conscious, speaking to you. So we've got good chance of making headway and chalking up those 10,000 hours of practice once we wake up to this. But I love the fact that this is to everybody. You know, some of us feel connected to past lives. I certainly feel connected to past lives. I'm an agnostic about reincarnation, but I have come to believe that the dramas and challenges of our present life are related to personalities living elsewhere, and I help people to explore that. But, Greg, I find in my connections with past lives, I've got a lot of karma to pay off. I often seem to be connected to men of power, whether it's royal power or priestly power, men who, you know, hoarded power and made it difficult for ordinary people to get to the good stuff. I've devoted my life to making it as easy as possible for people wherever they live to find direct ways of access to the worlds of spirit, soul, and the knowledge required to survive and thrive in our daily life.
That is absolutely beautiful. If you don't mind, I'd like to delve a little bit more deeply into your latest book, Mysterious Realities.
As an author, I'd love that. You know that.
This book is so full of stories where you encounter the dead, both in visitations and visits to places where they are living on the other side. So it beckons the question, it begs the question, is contact with the deceased really as natural and easy as you suggest? And, what are the rewards and really, what are the risks involved as well?
Well, let's just make it juicy by mentioning a principal reward immediately. First of all, healing and forgiveness are always available across the apparent barrier of death. And that's something that people really need to know, because if you've lost someone and things were not resolved and there's still bad blood, that is not an incurable situation. So let's list that as one of the rewards. Let's very quickly add another couple of rewards. First, another one is that our departed may return to us as counselors and family angels, really, when they've got themselves clear, and they can see things that we don't see, and they can give us important advice. I mean, my father did that for me and my family after his death 30 years ago, and he came back a couple of years ago, and I needed a personal health advisory coming back from a long distance. So as you can gather from what I've said so far, it's nothing exotic for me to think about talking to the dead. I've been talking to the dead all my life. Mm-hmm. And they're alive, of course. When the dead show up in your dreams, if you remember your dreams, they're typically alive. They're not dead. You might be surprised that they're still alive. So, the fact that the dead appear to us as alive in our dreams is the source of the long-standing human conviction that soul or consciousness survives physical death. So another reward of this engagement is to wake up truly to the fact that this life is not the end of your story. You're going somewhere else. So live this life and make choices in this life based on the understanding that there will be a life review following this life. You might feel ridiculous when you look back and see what you did or failed to do. One of the last stories in my new book, Mysterious Realities, called The Silent Lovers, is about the way I was recruited, to my shocked surprise, to play advocate for a man I'd never known in this life who's going through a life review on the other side of death. I mean, this is a fascinating insight for me into how sometimes we, the living, are required or invited to play guide for the dead. I mean, that can revolutionize your understanding of these things. Stepping back and responding to your general question, Greg, there are three reasons why contact with the deceased, especially in dreams, is not weird, it's not supernatural, it's not uncommon. It's actually the most natural thing in the world. So the first reason is the dead might still be around. They might be attached to you. That might be good, bad, or mixed. They might have stayed around because they're lost or confused or they're addicted. I mean, they might need help and separation might be required. And I teach people how to do that. The second reason the dead turn up is that they come visiting. And they come visiting for all the reasons we might call each other and then some. They come as family counselors. They come because they want healing and forgiveness. They come with specific messages. And the third reason why contact with the dead, especially in dreams, is not weird or unnatural is we go traveling. Back to the idea. Dreaming is traveling. And one of the realms we travel to in dreams is places where the dead are alive. And from those excursions, again, we gain firsthand knowledge of the Bardo states, of the states of the transitions after death. And this is important stuff to know about. I remember flying on a plane at one point. I have many adventures in my constant travels. And there's a whole family getting on the plane, and the matriarch of the family comes and sits next to me. And I have one of my books, Dream Gates, in a new edition on my lap. And she says, "I like the look of that book. May I see it?" "Oh, yes, certainly, the kind of woman you do not stand up to." So she grabs my book. She opens it at random, and she's looking at a section headed Designing a Home on the Other Side. And she looks at me, "Good God," she said, "is this possible?" I said, "Absolutely. You can participate in creating your afterlife environment." She says, "My God," she says, "I spent 20 years decorating my home in Carmel, California. I'm going to spend a lot more time over there. I better get your book and start working on my new life environment immediately." I mean, I love it. And by the way, I wasn't just joking. I mean, I've seen people do this. One of my stories in Mysterious Realities is about a cottage created on the other side by a mother and her daughter visiting her, following the path of moonlight and water. These things are real. We're talking about real words of imagination. where all of us are actually going to spend more time than we do in a life on this physical earth. So all of this is pretty relevant.
I got to tell you, I think you might have a whole new industry. It's interior design for the afterlife.
I love it. I'll start printing the cards and making the logo immediately.
I like it. You said something at the beginning of this that I thought was fascinating. The living could be a guide to the dead. What did you mean by that?
Well, Yeats said with poetic clarity, the living have the ability to assist the imaginations of the dead. And Yeats has been, or some version of Yeates, has been one of my advisors and guides in his realm for a long, long time. Very interesting fellow. I've noticed that sometimes the dead are stuck, lost, and confused. I mean, they're still addicted. They've got unfinished business. They're hanging around the living, and they need to be given some help and direction to move along. So that might be one aspect of it. Or they've moved a bit further away, but they're stuck in a very limited transition state. They don't seem to be able to receive guidance from anyone over there, maybe because they don't yet quite believe where they are or understand their situation. And the people that they might be most prone or available to hear from are living people who are familiar to them, family members, friends, etc., who seem to them still to be more solid and more believable than residents of their new realm. So we might sometimes, in a sense, have to intercede and say, look, you know, turn around. You've got more life options. You've got more job options. You've got more transition states available to you than you have yet realized. I mean, the story late in Mysterious Realities called The Silent Lovers absolutely astonished me. It began with a spontaneous dream in which I'm looking at a scene involving two gay men in an earlier time, 1940s. The scene is almost like a stage scene. They've had sex of a somewhat sterile kind, and I'm wondering as I surface in the dream, why am I looking at this? So I stay with the dream. I stay with the dream. This is the dream reentry I talked about. I stay with the dream, and I look at it, and I realize I am looking indeed at something like a stage performance from the seats in something like a theater, and sitting in the seats is the man, the attorney, who is about to be killed after this scene of rather sterile sex. He's watching himself. I think, oh, this is a life review. This is what goes on after death. I've seen this many, many times, Greg. It is for real. I mean, we do go through a life review. It's staged in different ways. So for some reason, I'm looking at the life review of a complete stranger of the scene that preceded his death, and I'm getting him feeling his concerns as he realized he lived a life without sentiment, without strong emotions. This is his great regret, and I'm thinking, if this is a life review of somebody beyond death, he must have an advocate. And I look, and the shadowy figure behind him is my double. I am his advocate, and suddenly I'm drawn into the scene. I'm in a lucid dream. Mm-hmm. You can call it a journey if you like. I've gone into it. No plant medicines, no drumming, nothing. I'm with him. And I'm now with him through the whole course of his life review up to the point where he makes a choice in his afterlife as to the next life he's going to lead. And he decides to be reborn again as a girl in Salvador da Bahia, Brazil, a place of music and passion, because he wants a life of emotion and feeling, and I know all his life. Anyway, I wrote a story from this. It might sound really strange. It was strange to me. I was shocked. I thought, why I've been drawn into the life of this man as an advocate, don't know him, nothing like him, nothing in common. And I'm told in my experience that it was a case given to me to test my ability as somebody who could play guide for people in these situations. And on this occasion, I managed to pass the test. So when you call yourself a guide, you must understand something about this. We are called upon in different ways to play guides in different ways, in different realms, in different worlds, for different people. I'm one of those who has occasionally, although I was told it's not really occasional, it's gone on for a long time, I'm occasionally called upon to be one of those people with a body in this earth who is invited to help people who are going through transitions on the other side. It might sound very odd that someone with a body in this world would be drawn into this position, but I think actually it's not all that strange. I think sometimes, as I say, for various reasons, someone in the body in this world is called upon to play a role as guide for someone in the other world.
Absolutely, and not strange at all. I have some friends that are ghost helpers, and that's exactly what they do on a regular basis.
Right.
Now, do you have any cautionary tales in dealing with the dead? Is there anything that we should be considerate about, responsible about, or just a little bit more respectful so we don't get ourselves into a scary situation?
Well, there's something fundamental, and it reflects the ignorance and loss of tradition in our society. We have to recognize there are multiple aspects of the dead. we're not just, I mean, even if we recognize that there is a soul as well as a body, many of us in our society have no education, no grounding to understand that there are multiple vehicles of consciousness, energy bodies that survive death and can operate with or outside the body during life. And at the very least, there's a dense energy body that survives the death of the physical body for some time and is supposed to go into the earth. Following that, there is a subtler body, we can call it the astral body, which travels around in dreams all the time in life and survives death and has another death. Beyond that, at the very least, there's a mental body or a spirit vehicle that transcends all of those. So at the very least, we have to recognize that if we're dealing with the dead, we need to have discernment about what aspect of the dead we're dealing with. I mean, we're not necessarily dealing with the rational, intelligent aspect of the dead or the spiritual aspect. We might be dealing with something that is either simply the leftover energy husk or shell of a person, or with a mind that is trapped in the energy husk or shell, so it can't think about anything beyond its ravening desire to get the next fix, to get sex or something like that. So developing a working spiritual anatomy of these things is going to be essential. And when you find that you have been intermeshed with the dead on the wrong level, you're going to have to learn to do a ceremony of separation. I write about this very explicitly in one of my books, The Dreamer's Book of the Dead. So this is a cautionary tale. Just to think it's all about body and soul and telling the departed to go into the light, I mean, that's very well and good luck with it, but we need to recognize that there are these multiple aspects of the dead and they need to be discerned and they need appropriate treatment.
And once again, if you want to find out about any of these books, the workshops, the talks, anything that Robert is doing right now, it's very, very simple. It's mossdreams.com. And if for some odd reason it slips out of your brain this evening, it will be on all of the social media on Inner Journey as of tomorrow. Robert, there are just so many different avenues that you and I could go down. But one of particular interest to me, just because of where I come from and who I've studied with, will you talk about the experiences of the Longhouse a little bit?
Well, these are people of dreams. They're people of dreams. I mean, my favorite reading when I started dreaming in an archaic form of the Mohawk Indian language were the Jesuit Relations. I'm one of the three scholars in the world who has the complete 78 volumes of the Jesuit Relations. These are reports sent back by the Jesuit missionaries from basically the 17th century, and they are, for those who can read through the veil of prejudice and suspicion, the best first-hand account from people, often very skilled anthropologists in their own way, of what the primal traditions of the Longhouse people were. The Confederacy of the Haudenosaunee or Gotinonunsi in the Mohawk language, which is slightly different, is a very precious tradition. From it, we derive the basic tenet of sustainability, that we must look down to the seventh generation beyond ourselves and understand the consequences of our actions. From it, we get the idea that a leader of people must be a Royana, a man of good mind, and in the tradition, a true chief of the Confederacy of the Longhouse is raised up by the clan mothers, by the women. He alone is allowed to wear the deer horn antlers of office, the antlers signifying connection with the spirit realm and the power of regeneration. And if he fails to serve as a man of good mind, he is dehorned by the clan mothers. Now, unfortunately, for a long time, it would be a great political system for us today. I'd love it, wouldn't you? But unfortunately, the tradition is not carried out in practice, but as an ideal system, it is very rich. What I knew about this most vividly came from the woman I call Island Woman in my books, Tewatakwas. She was born Huron-Wendat. She was captured by the Mohawk at age about five, adopted, and as so often happened amongst the Northeast tribes, becomes fully Mohawk, Kanyankahaka, people of the stone, is raised to become mother of the wolf clan of the Mohawk people. She called me in dreams. She instructed me. She taught me about what dreaming and healing were for her people. And here's a core understanding. She taught me that a dream might be an undinunk. An undinunk means a wish of the soul, especially as revealed in a dream, and that the first duty of decent people in a decent society is to gather round a dreamer who has a dream to tell and listen to what the soul might be saying and help that person to take action on what the soul is telling them. Because if you don't do that in the traditional teaching, your soul will eventually become disgust with you and take its distance, You might even join eventually the tradition, the procession of the walking dead. She also taught me something all our ancestors knew, which is that dreams might be for the survival of the community. They show you where you get the things you need in the starving time. They show you how to avoid enemies and ambush. So this is survival stuff. So her lessons from across 250 years coming to me. Why? Because we have a common connection with an Anglo-Irishman who came to the province of New York in colonial times. He's a distant ancestor of mine on my mother's side. We have some affinity. We have some transtemporal connections. She knew him and his life and didn't succeed in converting him altogether to her ways. But because of that connection across time, she came through to me. So what I know about the Longhouse people begins with her. And the Longhouse people I've met today are sometimes descendants of her and her family and of my Anglo-Irishman, Sir William Johnson. I was invited to teach 50 Mohawk women, Mohawk-speaking women, on a reserve in Canada who'd never invited a man or anyone from outside their tribe to their gathering before to help them dream again, following what I'd learned in part from Ireland Woman. And there I was, humbled and awed by the responsibility of bringing back an ancient system of dreaming gifted to me in my own dreams by one of their ancestors. And I'm looking across the table, and there are two beautiful women across the table, and their surnames are the names of my Anglo-Irishman and the only woman who ever tamed him, a Mohawk woman. And I'm there to bring back the dreaming by invitation from a healing grandmother, because I dream, as she said, the way we used to dream. I'm talking to you about things that are understood by all of our ancestors. They've atrophied or died out in so many ways. I'm not talking to you as a white man from Australia converted to a Native American tradition. That is not my story. I'm talking to you as a dreamer, a universal dreamer, who was drawn into that tradition because he moved to a certain geography and found connections with people across time as well as across dimensions, was then given certain assignments.
Now, Robert, this may seem a little pedestrian after that, but just so our listeners can catch up, can you explain the seven generations, please?
Well, the idea is that a true leader of people must consider the consequences of their actions down to the seventh generation beyond them. And this is the idea of the sustainability movement. It is borrowed directly from the traditional teaching of the Longhouse people. I apply it both ways. I apply it not only to the supposed future, but to the possible past. I think about the seven generations before me that lead up to my present life. And when I think about that, I think not only or primarily about genealogy, I think about that Mohawk Huron woman, that Arondiwana, the woman of power. She lived about seven generations before me, and I regard her as a spiritual ancestor. When I think about the seven generations ahead in personal terms, to make this fully personal, I think about a priestess scientist of the future, the possible future. She lives seven generations beyond me. I don't think she's a lineal descendant of mine in terms of genealogy, but she is a spiritual descendant. She is trying with her order of priestess scientists to rebuild our world after all the devastation wrought upon it by the idiocy, the greed, prejudice, the hatred of men. And I feel a responsibility to her. So when I talk about seven generations into the future, Greg, I'm not talking in the abstract. I picture her. I can see her. She looks a bit different from us because they have to do bioengineering very rapidly for their people to survive in a world that has a lot more water in it than ours does, but a lot less drinkable water. So they've evolved themselves. They've changed themselves. I can see her. I feel her. And I feel a responsibility to this remarkable woman working seven generations after us to sustain our world.
I absolutely agree. And I agree with what you're saying about directional. I look at the way that we operate more like throwing a pebble in a pond. It ripples out in every direction, not just in a linear fashion. And that way we affect our ancestors as much as our ancestors affect us into the future as well. Thank you. Unfortunately, we have come to that horrible point in the evening where I have to ask you the very last question of the eve. Is there anything at all that you'd feel remiss in not sharing with our listeners this evening?
Well, I want to circle back to how you introduced me. I mean, I'm a storyteller, and I noticed that we all do better when we find the ability to step outside our old, tired personal histories into a bigger and braver story. And that fundamentally is what my own teaching and writing is all about. It's what I try to do in my own life, step into the living myth that suits you and lifts you up and raises you up and helps you connect with people in a better way. What I try to do for other people is to make them aware that through dreaming and synchronicity, the other things we've been talking about, you have the power to step into your mythic life. You have the power to step out of the tired, old, used-up personal history into a bigger and braver story. That can give you the courage and clarity to change everything.
Absolutely beautiful. And I feel privileged, honored, and incredibly grateful that you have decided to share time with not only me this evening, but our listeners as well. Thank you so much for that.
It was a beautiful show, Greg. Thank you so much.
And I'm going to ask one last indulgence. If you could tell us who you are and that you're listening to Inner Journey, I would really appreciate it.
Well, I'm Robert Moss. I'm a storyteller and author of Mysterious Realities, and I am enjoying Inner Journey.
And we'll be back with more Inner Journey right after this short break.
Welcome to my nightmare. I think you're gonna like it. You belong. A nocturnal vacation, unnecessary sedation. You wanna feel at home, 'cause you belong.
Welcome to my breakdown. I hope I didn't scare you. That's just the way we are when we come down. We sweat and laugh and scream here, 'cause life is just a dream here. You know inside you feel right at you're welcome to my nightmare, yeah. Welcome to my
Welcome back to Inner Journey. A couple things. We have a Halloween fall festival and potluck here in town, Sunday, October 28th from 2 to 5 p.m. Check it out. Also, we have a great gig coming up for KX. Nancy Wilson of Heart is here on December 8th at the Irvine Bowl. It is going to be off the charts, a kick in the pants. It's not only Nancy Wilson, but it's a number of other bands that all have female lead singers. It's going to be women rocking the bowl, baby. All right. I say this every single week. If you want to find us on social media, Inner Journey with Greg Friedman. If you want to email us, it's greg@gregfriedman.com. There are so many people that work their tushies off behind the scene, and Susan Huff that comes and joins us to answer your email questions with me that I am hugely grateful for. But, and I do say this every single week because it is vital to me. It is really important that I express my gratitude to you, the listeners. This show does not exist without your participation. For that, and so, so much more. We are hugely grateful. You've been listening to Inner Journey with Greg Friedman. good night.